On a dark, moonless night, somewhere along the cold Atlantic coast, strange whispers stir among fisheries managers. A rumor is spreading, a shadowy threat lurking beneath the waves. They say they're coming, but no one can quite explain it. It's the striper year classes, the ones that don't exist. But oh, the danger they represent, or so we've been told. Could it be true? Is it a specter designed to spook us all into submission? What exactly is this mysterious unseen foe, this phantom of poor year classes that don't exist? A sinister prediction shrouded in uncertainty, ready to haunt any future over harvest. But where is the evidence? Is it a ghost story meant to keep us all on edge, or just another tall tale spun by those who claim to know more than they really do? Join us tonight as we dig into the mystery of missing year classes and the spooky stories of striped bass managers who swear their over harvest will be the end of us all. Tony and Kyle,
yes.
Welcome to the curious case of the mysterious year classes that don't exist.
Yup.
All right, Jim.
So they don't go bump in the night.
They do not go bump in the night, but apparently they pose a big threat to us all. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. We're jumping right into this rapid reaction. We've been on the TC presentation and questionnaire meeting from ASMFC for the last 2 hours and 35 minutes. We'll lay the groundwork with a little positive. Thank you to Emily and Katie for staying on for 2.5 hours to answer questions. The last meeting, big meeting that we had, where I had a little circus intro that some people might remember, we were on for 5-6 hours and like two people got to comment and there were a couple questions. So having the opportunity tonight was great. We heard a ton of great questions. We have basically everything recorded. I'm going to flip that into a separate episode so it doesn't bog this one down. This is our rapid reaction. Tony and our team dove into something, really two big aspects in the TC's report that came out that the Striped Bass Board is going to use for their decision making on the 16th. And this is the stuff we really want to lean in on for our public comments. And we're going to get into those aspects, but we have some really big concerns about what is currently proposed for the board to make decisions off of. I mean, in reality, at its highest level, and then we're going to dive into it, they've proposed a bunch of options that are largely no harvest closures. So you'd be allowed to fish, but you can't keep them. And they are very lengthy. And we know the uphill battle that would go with trying to get some of those enacted. And where it seems the board and certain parts of the board, will let you take a guess at which states, are driving the TC towards using a lot of energy and limited resources and limited time to keep a major emphasis on these no targeting closures. And what you'll see if you look in, we're going to have our full letter launched tomorrow. You'll have that as a resource. And you'll have our rapid reaction podcast. You'll also have our action alert page on the ASGA website to have all of this information. But what you're going to see is they are very inequitable closures. Some of them, we have Kyle Schaefer on here, who's a guide in Maine. To consider the fact that Maine might be shut down for the same total amount of days as a state further down that has 3 or 4 times the amount of striped bass season is totally ludicrous. So I don't want to jump into the specific details we're going to in a second. Tony, from a high level, what the hell are we thinking? Where the hell do we go?
So, Cody, this stuff is so complicated, you know. There are some people that couldn't even find the document. When people saw the document, they were asking me questions. A lot of people asked me the same question. What's a wave? You find the meeting document. You have to scroll 72 or 77 pages down before you get to something that's labeled as a memo. That's the report. This whole thing is a pretty big, it's a pretty big mess. So I'm going to give everyone a super fast recap. This is what's on the table. You know, you have various, okay, first of all, a wave is 2 months. The first wave is January and February. Wave one. The last wave is wave six, November and December. Be really nice to put that on a legend or something so maybe people could actually participate, but I'll just keep going on. So there's a lot of stuff on the table, and you look at a no harvest closure, no targeting closure. You know, what can we do with the slot size? And you know, there's not a lot on the table because we have one fish in a very thin slot right now. And every year that goes by that we don't have a good spawn, it gets worse and worse. So we have, this is the only document, y'all, that we don't really support. I'm just going to be honest. There are so many flaws in each potential option. And, I'll start by asking Kyle a question. And, you know, Kyle's question at the meeting, Kyle, why don't you basically say what your question was at the meeting? And Kyle is a guide in Maine. So there's nothing else for him to catch. His season is shortest on the coast. Besides North Carolina, they just don't have a season because there's no fish. But Kyle's availability for striped bass is the shortest on the coast besides places that just don't have them anymore. So, Kyle, why don't you say what your question was and kind of the situation, the bind that this puts you in. And, Kyle, I want to say one more thing. I've known Kyle for a while. You never meet a more conscientious person when it comes to someone whose profession is a guide and the consideration that this young man takes into every aspect of his impact on the resource. There may be some people that are equal to Kyle in that commitment. There's nobody who puts more heart and shoulder into it. So whatever Kyle says, just frame it with that. You're up, bud.
Well, thank you, Tony. All right. So, well, my question was short and sweet. There was a lot of questions tonight. And so pretty much mine, word for word, was I'm all for making sacrifices to repair this fishery. But with Maine having such low removals and therefore a much lower impact on the fishery as a whole, combined with a short season, why is it equitable to have an option where Maine would be required to take the same length of a seasonal closure to that of a state that has an exponentially greater harvest? And, you know, and I think that stings even a little bit more for Maine, where, you know, the law enforcement committee really feels that, you know, the closures are unenforceable. And so to have something that wouldn't be really effective to fix the problem that we're all working so hard to address, instead it would just have this wonky effect on the fishery, and essentially, you know, I wouldn't be able to guide a third of my season, or more. But
and Ben so Wally, for sure. Ben Wally, who's also a guide up in Maine, who you know, Kyle, made a very good point as well. He brought up the considerations, how much resources and time were put into the considerations of these no targeting closures. Is there anything that represents the impact on effort before and after them? Because in Ben's words, he said, if y'all do this, I'm going to just basically put in as many trips into daylight hours that I possibly can before and after. So your whole goal is to limit trips. But what if I just guide double before and after because I still have to make income? The same fear and threat that you have. And their answer to that, and I'll preface, I want to take this note and preface back at everything you're going to hear tonight. We asked a lot of questions, and I think for the most part exposed a lot of the answers we knew. Their answer was, we have no clue. We don't know if that actually has anything. And so this leads in perfectly, Tony. I'm fired up about what I commented on, but we should go into yours from this. From the no targeting closures, that was the emphasis. And Katie admitted that the board drove the focus on no targeting closures. And Tony, I think you had a pretty interesting opinion on where the hell is all this drive that these no targeting closures are incredible and that they work. Why don't we jump into your comment a little bit here? Where did this all come from?
So this, I mean, this came as a punitive deal. It started in Maryland, the idea of no targeting closures started in Maryland. And it was started by DNR, specifically Mike Luisi. And he basically was going to get fired by the Hogan administration. There was this creepy guy that would stand behind Mike at every meeting named Mike Anderson, I think his name was. didn't know which end of a fish to grab, was a political appointee, and basically told Mike every day if he didn't do exactly what he said and get the results, that he was going to get fired. And, you know, what were the results? The results were do anything you can for the commercial industry. And the reason behind that is when Hogan was getting elected for his first term, Anthony Brown was the lieutenant governor. And I'm giving y'all a background, but somebody needs to tell this truth. Somebody ought to write a book. So, the Hogan was way behind Maryland's blue state. And he went down to a Hogan rally down south where I live. And they thought, you know, 500 people are going to show up, and 5,000 people showed up. And since that point on, Hogan thought that the Waterman community turned the election around for him. They went in the day that Hogan was elected with a sheet of paper and said, these are the people that we want fired. And they got fired. And I could tell you each person and their story and where they work now. So, and that was kind of the downfall of Maryland DNR. They would go around and monitor the phone calls of DNR employees. I mean, it was like working at the Gestapo. And there's a reason why I'm saying all this. So under those directions, they said, well, we got to take these reductions are coming, you know, striped bass are in trouble. So we got to rob Peter to pay Paul. We're not going to take reductions on the commercial, and we're going to put an extraordinary burden on the recreational fishery. And if you don't believe me, look at the history of what Maryland has done to recreational fishermen and the fact that commercial fishermen haven't taken squat of any kind of reduction. Bay has the tiny little Chesapeake Bay has the same poundage quota as a whole freaking ocean. Okay. So these no targeting closures were conjured up by Maryland to take away from the recreational angler so they didn't have to take anything from the commercial angler. And this, you know, a 7% reduction, well, they never had to take it because it was off quota and not harvest. And, you know, prior to that, there have been no reductions. And before the first reductions, they actually took an increase. I could talk about this all day and all night. So here's the deal. Maryland conjured up, oh, we're going to do no targeting. So and then all of a sudden, you know, everybody's blaming catch and release mortality on everything. But, you know, look, y'all, you're not looking at the numbers. It's 42% now. It's 42%. And with the dramatic decrease in recreational effort, guess what? It's going to be less than that in 2024. The argument's done. We have mass DMF study. We're not 9% mortality. These people conjured up these no targeting closures. And here's where the rubber meets the road. They submitted a report to the technical committee. And I'm going to read this, and I read my quote. I'm going to read this, and I read this quote tonight for the questions, and here it is. This is straight out of the documents that were impossible to find. This is page 82 of the 131-page document. First paragraph: in the case of Maryland's previous Chesapeake Bay seasonal closure, which is a targeting closure analysis, the quote eliminate striped bass only trips end quote seemed like a reasonable assumption given the dynamics of the Chesapeake Bay fishery, which are heavily focused on targeting striped bass. Few alternative targets exist for the species. This assumption was validated by realized reductions in Maryland that exceeded expected reductions. So what Maryland did was say, oh my gosh, look, we exceeded expected reductions. It must be the no targeting closure. So we spent 4 hours today picking that shit apart. And guess what? All you have to do is go to the MRIP site and query effort for directed trips for striped bass for Maryland and go year by year by year. And then you can drill down and you can go wave by wave by wave. So I want you to understand this. 2018, first no targeting closures. 2020, Next, the expansion of the target enclosures. Here are the trips. 2016, 2.2 million. 17, 2.1 million. 18, 2.1 million. Where's the drop in effort? That was the target. That was the first year of no targeting. 19, 1,500, 1.5 million. 20, 2.1 million. Well, wait, it increased. That was the expansion of the no targeting. 21, 1.5. 22, 1.6, 23, 1.4, 24, 539,000 through wave four. Now, real quick, and I'm going to finish my point here, y'all. So, All Harvest Maryland, 2016, okay, 2.2 million trips, 15 million total catch. 17, 2.1 million trips, 8.8 million. 18, 2.1 million trips, 8.4 million. Wow, is that less fish? Are we starting to see the fish decline? 19, 1.5 million, 7 million total catch, a little bit less trips. 20, here's the kicker, 2.1, massive increase, 7.7 million, less catch for more trips. Wow, now here starts to get real bad. 1.5 million trips, 2021, 4.5 total catch, million. 1.6, in 2022, 1.6 million, 4 million fish. 2023, 1.4, 3.6 million. So let's do a little history here. 2016, stock a lot healthier. 15 million total catch, 2.27 million trips. Fast forward, 2023, 1.4 million trips, 3 million fish. The catch per trip has been cut by like 300%. But it must be the no targeting closures. So my point was, how can you base a brand new management structure on a false assumption? The false assumption is this. This assumption was validated by realized reduction in Maryland that exceeded expected reductions. Well, I asked the staff at ASMFC, non-targeting is an effort reduction, right? It's an effort. It's a choice to reduce effort. Well, guess what? It didn't. People aren't fishing because there's no fish. Look at the stock status. Look at the amount of fish caught. Look at the amount of trips. The amount of trips that we're catching, amount of fish we're catching per trip is down, you know, from what, 16... in 16, 2.2, 15 million. So like seven fish per trip. 2023, 1.4 million, 3 million fish. That's two fish per trip. Boy, those non-targeting closures are working. So let's take that, the bullshit that Maryland sends the technical committee, accept it as gospel, and then apply it to the coast because they've made nothing but bad decisions for the last 10 years. And they're just trying to destroy the last of our businesses. So that's my thought on no targeting closures.
And so, Tony, you made this comment, right? And the response was, this is what came out of Maryland in their last presentation. And it had a big effect on effort and it went down. And you very abruptly responded, no, it went up. And there was kind of a little bit of a lack of reaction, some silence. And then just... basically, the response was, well, that's what Maryland said. So how are we proposing something at a coastline level that is that significant to impact millions and millions of dollars of business? And we're going off of, well, that's what Maryland said. And I'm waiting now where the audio transcript of this is loading. We're processing our own because we don't have time for this to all, you know, wait to get uploaded because all of this shit hits the rubber meets the road in like 5 days, right? So we're processing our own transcript. I'll be able to read it word for word. But it was basically Maryland told us so. So we just didn't even look into it any further. What I think is just totally disingenuous. And I'm going to lean in now on what I focus my comment on. This is the second logical fallacy that we found in this TC presentation. And so for anyone who has the draft agenda for this meeting and has the memorandum in front of them, on page, I want to get it right so everyone can see it. And we know this, like Tony said, it's been hard to find this. So we'll have all these resources available online. So on page 23 of the memorandum, that's page 96 of the draft agenda, there's a simulation analysis for slot sizes under 28 inches. And so this data in that simulation directly contribute to any inclusion of any potential regulations that are shorter than the current slot. On page 80, it says, targeting fish smaller than 28 inches could shift harvest away from the 15 and 18 year classes that may be desirable by some stakeholders from a management perspective. Bingo, ding dong, right? Yeah, it actually is very desirable from a management perspective from some stakeholders, the ones who have any sort of sense, but I digress. But harvest of immature fish would increase, resulting in a loss of spawning potential for the stock. And that's been really hard for us to sit with. Me and Tony have been talking about that, and Tony's been like, it just doesn't make any sense. How would that be possible? The data apparently says it. We always go by the best available data and the best available science. We can't oppose our core ethos as an association. But then Tony found something earlier today that is the key to all of this. And what it says in the appendix is it states that for all slot limit analyses, 2018 removals data were used in table one as a proxy for 2025 to reflect the availability of a strong 2018 year class that will be age seven in 2025, just as the strong 2011 year class was age seven in 2018. Okay, what does that mean? I'm going to try to boil it down in a short but sweet sentence. They're saying we should consider 2011 to 2018 as an exact proxy replacement for the state of the fishery from 2018 to 2024, just because the first year in both of those six-year periods are spikes. They're big years. There's a couple issues with that. The first is the spike in the first time series was, I think, a 35 on the index. So 11 is the time series average for this fishery, juvenile abundance indice out of the bay, which contributes like 80%+ of all the striped bass that are spawned for the coastwide stock. Okay. 2011 was a 35. 2018 was about a 15. So right away, you're not comparing apples to apples. But then you look at, we've actually laid it out in a graph. This will go live in our intel and information tomorrow. The arithmetic mean for the 5 years that follow, or the 6 years that follow, excuse me, in the Bay YOY for that first window is 13.2. So still higher than the time series average for this fishery. The arithmetic mean from 18 to 24 is 4.35. Okay, so you have 25% of the total spawning production, 75% less of the total spawning production, okay, in these two time series. And we're being told if we shift the slot lower, we will tee off on these fish. There's no way that there could be any sort of reduction by fishing on these fish. And our question is, where are these fish? These are the spawn numbers. The bay makes up a vast majority of all the striped bass that are born, and these time series show what is to come. And in Katie's response to me, she referenced about how they're looking 10 years out on this fishery. Okay, for one, the management decisions here are to rebuild by 2029. So I don't even know why we're talking about 10 years out. We should be talking about the next 6 years and that they're afraid we're going to over-harvest fish that don't exist. It's plain and simple. And so I asked, someone asked earlier something along those lines, but didn't get as in-depth into the numbers. And the response to them was, well, time was so limited and resources were so limited to prepare this. And my question was, if time was so limited, why were so many resources allocated to these no targeting closures? And Tony, who were we told them to prioritize no targeting?
So the board did. They said,
bingo,
prioritize no targeting. But it wasn't the board. It wasn't the board. It was a couple of members who are just like either commercial fishing apologists, which is fascinating to me because commercial fishery has not taken the same reductions that we have taken, not even close. So it's just a couple of people on the board that are manipulating this. And I, for the life of me, fisheries is supposed to be a massively, publicly influenced arena. That's why we have these meetings. That's why we make comments. That's why we do all this stuff. And to just think that there are no more than, I don't know, four people, five people that are driving this insanity. And they're, oddly enough, they're the same five people that have led the charge on all the bad decisions that got us here. Fascinating, right? Fascinating. You know, do we forget about Amendment 1? So it was... It was Addendum 1 to Amendment 7. What was that? We fought for years to get Amendment 7, right? Does anyone remember what Addendum 1 is? I do. John Clark, Delaware. I want quota transfers so the eight people who Gillnet in Delaware can kill pregnant females en route to drop their eggs, even though Delaware doesn't have any fish anymore. And really it is like not even, there's really not even like any spawning that occurs in Delaware anymore. But let's gillnet them. And then 2-3 years before we get the quota transfer, why don't we sneak in? Why don't we sneak in a quick meeting to double the area where anchored gillnets are allowed? Real close to the choke point. To a choke point in Delaware Bay where they just don't have a freaking chance. We'll do that. That's a good idea. That's a good idea.
Well, I found it really interesting, Tony, in Katie's response, okay? This is word for word what she said. I think the other thing to consider, though, is it's true that, you know, protecting the 2018s and 2015s is worthwhile because those are what is supporting the rebuilding trajectory. But thinking ahead to the future, those 2018s and those 2015s will not last forever. So our only two good year classes won't last forever. So,
well,
what are we not going to do to protect them? We
have Maybe I'll send Katie the mass DMF otolith study that the 50-inch fish we're catching right now are probably the 1996 year class. So we'll have these fish around for another 23 years because they're 7 years old. I'm not trying to sound like a lunatic on this. And I don't ever scream on these podcasts. I'm sorry about that. But it's so frustrating. They can't even accurately project out 10 years and you're worried about a fish that has a longevity that can regularly exceed 30 years. The big fish that the commercial guys are killing with gill nets when they're swimming into spawn in Delaware Bay, in the Chesapeake Bay, catching hook and line in Massachusetts, none of these have maximum size limits. These are 30-year-old fish. So, okay, Katie, in 33 years, they might not be around. I'm okay with that.
Let's be very explicit. I, at the end, said, who tasked the priorities here for these presentations? The board. The board is the one who tasks us with this and tells us what the priorities are. And so this was what the priorities that we got from the board was and what we have presented to you here today. So if the board would like us to work on this further, meaning exploring going into smaller slot classes, they can task us with that at the next meeting. So there it is. It's not that the science doesn't exist and that the numbers aren't there. This was intentionally not explored. You just touched on the commercial aspect. Blaine had a great question at tonight's meeting. Shout out to Blaine for bringing up the equity of commercial versus recreational. I mean, you referenced Boston Harbor. How ridiculous would it be to be someone who is a full-time guide in Boston Harbor and they can't launch their boat in what I believe is July and August, correct, Tony? One of the key wave options that would apply
so, you know, to Boston. Yeah, the state would pick a waves, you know, plus or minus, it's 60 days, 2 months. So if you talk about a 25-day closure, it could either be like, well, you know, all of July except for the first 5 days. You can do it anyway, 25 days. You could probably do 2 weeks in the beginning of July and 2 weeks at the end of August, right? I who the hell knows? It's like trying to nail Jell-O to a tree.
Imagine being one of the full-time guides, sitting at the dock, knowing you can't launch your boat and that you're not allowed to target striped bass. And then there are commercial guys sitting in the middle of the harbor teeing off on feeds. And you're sitting on the outside and you potentially could get a fine if you pick up a rod and cast it in that same feed.
Oh, you mean like the Chesapeake?
And meanwhile,
you mean like meanwhile, the freaking Chesapeake that we live happen, with every day?
Exactly. And meanwhile,
they're like, don't touch your rod, evil man. Yeah, don't touch a rod, evil man, or we'll throw you in jail. And I look out from where I live and there's like 3 pound nets that fish 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And hook and line season's open and, you know, just whole things. Yeah, you mean like what we live every day? Just give the bay over to them. Yeah. And oh my God, Cody, the one guy came on and he's like, we have 1% release mortality. I'm like, please. Like, you know what? Somebody says that 2 or 3 more times, that's going to be the next thing we go after. So I'd really watch what you're saying, because that is the furthest thing from the truth. Cody, last meeting in October, remember how we were laughing about it? Remember how we were laughing about it? Because one of the pound netters in the Potomac, who's on the commission, that has the 1% release mortality for stripers, he went on record and said that the Potomac Rivers Fisheries Commission should let him kill more redfish because there's hundreds of them in his net and they're all dying. So I'm going to pause, dramatic pause here.
1 cent.
For any of our listeners in the Northeast who aren't familiar with redfish, if I was going to compare the durability of a redfish, I mean, Kyle, help me out here. The durability of a redfish and the durability of a striper, I would say one is a Toyota Corolla and the other is an Abrams tank. I mean, I don't know. If you ever catch a redfish, just knock on its head. It sounds like a coconut. You know, just take your knuckle and just be like, tuk, 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 Kyle. Any thought? So if you're killing hundreds of redfish in your pound net, tell me about your 1% release mortality in the commercial fishery. Stop it. Stop it. Kyle?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, my take on the meeting, and just kind of sometimes I feel like I take a little bit of a step back is just like, you know, it's been, and I commend everybody for staying engaged and asking questions and sticking with this process, because it can be so long and arduous. And, you know, and here we are sitting on 6 years in a row of essentially failed spawns, trying to divvy up this pie in a way that is, you know, really clunky at best. And, you know, I think it just makes for a really messy process, you know, at this point. And it's tough when we can't believe in, you know, the document and how the information is being presented. You know, so it's just hard to predict how this is going to go, Cody, you know?
Yeah. And Kyle, how you said that too, is like, can't believe in it from the perspective of someone trying really hard to understand and respect it. I think that's an important aspect too. We're not sitting on the sidelines just yelling, the data is wrong, let me do whatever I want. There are other people doing that. We're trying, okay, how do you guys calculate this? Okay, where did all these numbers come from? Listening to every one of these different presentations and going through these 100-page documents and trying to figure out where the system is not set up to reward someone who tries their best to play by the rules. We saw that in the last meeting that I ironically dubbed the circus, because there were like 4 public comments taken at the end in a very critical meeting. And there were a bunch of public comments taken during the questions period, right? So alone, if you just ignored what these ladies and gentlemen were asking us to do, hey, leave your comments for the comment section. We want to answer questions about the data and regulations proposed, et cetera. If you played by the rules, you got burned. But everyone else got their minute on the mic. And the tough part about it, Kyle, is you can't unsay something, right? So if I log on and I say what I say, they can't stop everyone from unhearing. what I said. There was 435 people on this meeting. It might have been higher. I think I saw like 430 at least today, mm-hmm. right? So when you get on the mic, you're on the mic and you can't unsay it. So that's another big part of that that can be a little infuriating. And I think our community, the conservation community, did a great job of making sure things were set in stone, because our issues have never been with the scientists. You know, these guys are tasked with diving into all these insane numbers and trying to make it palatable and present options to the management board. The onus of managing the species has always been on that board. And so like Nick Jones asked a great question, and essentially he said, because a couple of people had already brought up the unenforceability of the no targeting. And he brought up that it was put on record that target enclosures were the least enforceable of the 26 different options. So he also recognized that law enforcement's underfunded, understaffed, and if target enclosures are essentially unenforceable, they take away a lot of legitimacy to this process. And so Nick asked, has their position, the LEOs, changed on the enforceability of target enclosures since the last meeting? Very specific response, clear and cut, no. Their law enforcement committee's position has not changed. It's up to the board to decide how to weigh it in terms of moving forward. Plain and simple, these are unenforceable and they are still unenforceable and nothing has changed. And if anyone's going to ignore the fact that making these fraudulent rules up that are unenforceable, that again, we also hear from the other side, oh, I represent the working class, the people who don't have expensive center consoles and expensive fly rods. I'm people who want to put meat on their table and barely have a penny in their pocket. Okay, well, if there's fines enacted on fishing for these fish and no targeting closures, who's going to be able to afford those fines? Someone who's got a bunch of bread and a big boat and says, my kids are only home from the summer for a handful of days. I'm going fishing. If I get caught, I'll pay the $250 fine. I don't care. That's not the same for the people who are on the shore, got a little tin boat and get the chance to get out once a week and really just want to keep a fish, you know, for their family that they're allowed to legally within the slot. Right. Well, so Cody, actually the underserved and disadvantaged are actually further disadvantaged by the fact that it just basically becomes a pay to play, pay for rod ticket if you participate when you're not supposed to participate.
Cody, you've kind of used that example before. And just for the audience, you know, he uses that example because I have several people that I know that just kind of take that approach, that exact approach in Maryland where there's no target enclosures, not guides. Private rec anglers that their kids are home from college. They don't have much time to spend with their kids. And they're like, write me the ticket. I don't care. $100, $150. I don't give two shits. You're not going to take this away from me. That's the truth. And I got to tell you, I don't blame them. We're science-based. We adhere to the regulations. We do everything. But when you hear somebody you know say that and you really think about it as a dad, kids 20, 21, going to be finishing school, moving out. Lord knows where they'll move or get a job. And you got time slipping out of the hourglass with your children. And you want to spend quality time and have quality memories. Is that worth a $100 ticket? To most people I know it is. I don't condone it. I'm not saying that I support it, but I do understand it. So look, okay, so now we've covered, now we're going to get real wonky. So look, in our original letter, we supported no harvest closures, okay? However, these are not equitable. You know, a 60-day harvest closure in Maine, I mean, sometimes somebody won't take something home. Maine represents a pinprick of the harvest. So does New Hampshire. You take that away from them and then watch what'll happen. You got a state like Maine and they got to take it in a certain wave because the fish aren't available for very long. And then watch what New Jersey will do. New Jersey will be like, I'll take a closure the last days of December. And then in, you know, some other part of the year where we don't have fish, we're doing our part. And they have the flexibility to do that. It was reviewed in the comments in the document that a state like Delaware could pick wave two, wave four, wave five, wave six. You know, they pick whatever they want. I bet you Kyle would like it if Maine was wave six. Yeah, November, December. I promise you I won't go fishing in Maine for stripers. I promise. Pinky swear. Let's do that.
Kyle guarantees he won't fish in January. He promises. He promises.
Yep, I guarantee. So, just give me December.
Yeah, man. Yeah, man. So,
and I do just want to point out, Tony, what you just said about being equitable from the no harvest closure proposals. Ding, ding, ding. Did you not just advocate for people's right to be able to harvest a fish? So all the people who've tried to claim that we're eco-terrorists who want to shut down the oceans, that no one should be allowed to keep a fish for a table, and that everyone wants to turn them into a fairy tale, mess with them and put them back, fishery, da-da-da-da-da. No, no, no. We're not supporting this because it's unequitable in people's ability to keep a fish for the table. We haven't pushed for that. So it's disingenuous for the conversations around our perspective, which has always been what is the best available option to make sure there's always a lot of fish in the water for everyone to use however they like. Commercial, harvest, catch and release.
So it's a fairness issue. And maybe I have an issue with that at my core. I just know that, you know, the states, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Maine, to some degree, even Connecticut, and certain, you know, the Montauk area in New York, not like down around the city. They have much shorter seasons. That's it. And it's not fair. I mean, it's just not. If you're entrusted with managing these fish and you can't recognize that a state like New Jersey has a 300-day season or more, and Kyle has a 90-day season, and that should be smoothed out, I don't know what to say. So look, y'all, we're not going to support a no harvest closure, and we're not going to support a no targeting closure. And I think we detailed about the no targeting closure. So I think it's about time we get a little wonky and we talk about moving around the slot. And this we're fixing to get into the weeds. So y'all just buckle up. And Cody, you know, I think I would like you to explain this. This was your comment. I think you did a stellar job. You rattled the hell out of staff. So I think you should probably tell this story about the slot limit.
It's just being based off of an assumption, the proxy decision that has, I'm not saying it's completely irrelevant or erroneous, so that was picked out of thin air. It was picked because of a spike of a high year class to start. They're looking at the age length dynamic of these fish and how old these fish will be and how big these fish will be in a time series. And they picked it because 11's a spike and 18's a spike, and then there's a short year after it. And the only real logical lack of consideration for it is you could say that the year after that spike is both a drop off, so there might be some sort of consideration there for equivalency or comparison. But there is no consideration for the fact that after those first 2 years in this time series, there are no fish coming. And so the response to my comments was not erroneous either. The response to my comment was a very appropriate response if there were some healthy spawn or even average spawn classes in this time series to back up 18 to 2024 after 18 and 19. But you can't tell us the effort will be shifted and, oh, you just have to understand that those younger classes haven't experienced natural mortality. They haven't died as much. So there's more of them. I understand all those dynamics. They don't exist. You have to show us where those fish are. The JAI says that those fish were never born. They don't exist in the estuaries that we look for the little fish to see that they are going to come into the estuary. That has been, we had Marty on, I don't even know how many episodes ago, that MDJAI is the gold standard for predicting striper abundance over time. It's been a perfect reflection of everything that has gone on and all the management decisions that have impacted them. And all the responses to where spawns could be happening other places, they're happening up in Canada, just north of you, Kyle. That's the new claim, right? The Canadian stock's its own independent stock. It's been proven it actually has subpopulations. So some of the rivers up in Canada are actually genetically different from each other. And then you come down back into the east coast of the United States, which is the actual coastwide stock that we're talking about managing. And the spawn production has not picked up anywhere. Ironically, you have a lot of people that I'm sure do not believe in climate change or support the phrase of climate change in general partisan politics outside of fisheries. Those same guys are just willing to say it's the climate change around here and you guys just aren't considering that it's the climate change and they're all spawning up in New York now. That doesn't exist. You have zero data to prove that any of that is going on.
Oh, so no, again, hold on. Long, let me just not can I throw one other thing in. This is totally pertinent. Keep riffing. We know that the Hudson spawn is going to suck this year. That information will come out before the meeting. Look, it's our job to know this stuff. The Hudson spawn is terrible. And I guess that throws that argument out the window. Cody, Kyle, do we need better data? That's for our long-time listeners. We need better data.
Yeah. Yeah, I think if you played striped bass bingo, striped bass bullshit bingo that we made a couple of years ago, you probably like filled your bingo board twice. I think you win a gift card to the ASGA shop or something like that. But these fish aren't spawning anywhere else, and they're not spawning where they should be spawning. And there's no other spawns going on further up the coast significant enough to keep up with the major producer down south, the bay. So you can't tell us. And again, they didn't say that they ran all the projections and it proved that a shift down on these smaller year classes would do it. We were explicitly told there was no time and resources to do it. And I understand. I'm not saying like, hey, you should just work until 4 a.m. and that these scientists should have no lives. And they're also being tasked with very big, very, very big tasks in a short time window. But as an advocate, so are we. We just had this meeting tonight. We get our chance to ask questions. We're not going to sleep at all. We're going to get all of our resources live tomorrow. There's a 2-day weekend and no one does anything on the weekends of accountability, right? Everyone wants to go out and actually fish or enjoy, you know, their lives. So I'm going to have Monday and Tuesday to amplify this message and tell people whether or not they agree with us that they need to comment. So our time as an advocate who wants to stand up for this resource is also very short. And you can't tell us that there just wasn't enough time to consider something that on page 80, you guys blatantly call out, you recognize that it would be a major priority for many advocates and stakeholders. So how can you call out that it's a major priority for stakeholders, but you just didn't have enough time to do it? It's ridiculous. And you prioritized all the things that the board wants out of this. And that's when you get into the point of the data is the data and we don't debate it. We sat all day today querying MRIP and going through every damn number in this document. And we built our own graphs. Right? We ran our own. And I'm not saying that we're any smarter when it comes to fisheries science and stock assessments than some of these brilliant scientists. But there is time to allocate to figure out if this was an option. We were told that it never was an option. That's our biggest issue. Sliding the slot down would be a priority. And so why am I more afraid of teeing off on a bad class that you're telling me maybe is a good class, but you've told me already with the JAI it's a bad class? Why do I have to be more scared of teeing off on a bad class when in reality we have two good classes and you told me in your response to me word for word, they're not going to exist forever? So that's always been the priority of this management since I've been involved with it, Tony. It's They're not going to exist forever, dot, dot, dot. So we should tee off on them while they're here now.
You know, so where does this leave us? We talked about no targeting closures and how that's based on a throne of lies from Maryland and how it did not affect effort and how abundance drives effort, not a no targeting closure. Look at it this way. If you had a 2-week no targeting closure, you knew it was coming, how would you organize your life? Same way that Ben would do it in Maine. Get all your honeydews done in those 2 weeks. Maybe, I don't know, you know, get your honeydews done, catch up on life. And then before and after that 2-week closure, you go fish your butt off. That's how anyone would do it. Anyway, it's just a joke. So,
and if you think about any guide, right, a sensible guide, I'm sure Kyle has these considerations on his own trips. And feel free to tangent if you have any more on this, Kyle. But like, you have times, right, where maybe you're on a certain point and the fishing's really good. And it could be every bite for 2 hours if you wanted to sit there. But as a guide, even if you wouldn't say this to your client, you might be, all right, this has been pretty fun. Let's go see if this other thing's going on. You manage your resource, right? Like, you don't need to beat the brakes off of them on one individual day, but your goal is to manage a client book and their experiences for the entire season. So a smart guide would say, why don't we not crush every redfish in this hole? Why don't we not crush every striper on this point? I kind of like them for there to be there tomorrow for my next client to enjoy as well. How are you going to look at this perspective as a guide? If you're not allowed to fish for them for 30 days, you're going to beat the ever living brakes off of them every day that you can. So you talk about the 9% release mortality on average, recognizing that, again, the data shows it's smaller for single hook fly, but I digress. You look at that data and say, all right, you have the 9% release mortality on all those release fish. And what if you're a guy who likes to keep your limit for all your anglers? You run a bay boat. You're going to make sure you get every limit you can if you don't have 30 days. And so not having any sort of recognition for how that would impact the fishery, again, as I just think maybe the data is very difficult to understand that, but just going off of because Maryland said so is not a good enough standard. I'm curious what your perspective is on that, Kyle, as a guide.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's like we've got like four different seasons, you know, six different seasons within our summer when we have striped bass here. I mean, like losing May and June is like, that's a time where I would book clients that want to connect with a lot of fish. They want to see surface feeding. I mean, July and August is, you know, I mean, I guess parts of June too is, you know, turns into kind of big fish, like swing for the fences. Like, let's go hunt a big fish on sand or do something tough. And we've got some great offshore fishing, you know, and then September, October, of course, things start fully shifting again. And so I think if you lose like a condensed little part of your season, you're really losing, at least for me, in the way that I like to guide, like you're losing just a whole unit. You know,
a whole chapter of your story.
Yeah, a whole chapter for sure.
And you just brought up a really good point. Depending on which waves are selected for your state, you said, or I'm paraphrasing, right, and dialing down a little bit, but early season, lots of numbers, smaller fish, middle of the season, big fish. If they take away your middle of your season, which is your big fish, and the stock's currently set up where there's no small fish, you just have nothing. You're going to have 30 days of shitty fishing and then 30 days of no fishing. That's the experience that they've given you and your anglers and your.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, I mean, it's just a tough position to be in. You know, Maine, New Hampshire, Mass, I think would all feel that very similarly, you know, especially the North Shore of Mass, north of Cape Cod. But yeah, absolutely. So it's, I mean, and especially when you're talking about like, you know, just coming back to that the board wanted to explore that and that we know that it's not enforceable and that it doesn't have any foundation below it is just, it's tough.
And another really weird aspect, Kyle, I don't think we've talked about it yet so far, but like people brought up the distinguishing line between Rhode Island and Massachusetts. We had a call with Mike Hogan from Hoagie Lures recently, and he was talking about a trip that he was on that they were recording and how basically they were pushing the boundary of like, where they were fishing, not knowing if they were in Massachusetts or Rhode Island. And obviously the guide on the time knew, but like, you know, from a not 200 day a year guide who's dialed in on their fish, blurring those lines between where you fish, how can you tell Massachusetts they're shut down, but Rhode Island isn't in a given wave where all of those fish are in that area or vice versa? I mean, the difference between New Jersey and Maine is very different, right? Where the fish are and where that giant biomass is or isn't. How do you tell Rhode Island versus Massachusetts guys where the difference could be a mile or less?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that even further kind of drills into just how it just doesn't make sense, you know, and I live too. I mean, I know New Hampshire and Maine would technically be in the same grouping, but you know, that I launch my boat on a river that splits New Hampshire and Maine every day. And so like, I can just see how, you know, fisheries blurring those lines get really tricky. You know, I mean, I'm in New Hampshire, I'm in Maine, I'm always originating in Maine, but it's, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And you referenced how Maine, and I think Ben might have as well referenced how Maine, where you don't have a lot of biodiversity, just the way that the Gulf is set up. And so you don't have this excuse as much, but how do you prosecute someone who is sitting in a blitz that might have bluefish and stripers in it, and they're throwing a small bait? They're trying to get bluefish. And how can you prove, other than a striper being in their cooler and that they're very explicitly breaking the law, which also applies, that's enforceable against no harvest as well, the fish is in the cooler. How can you prove that that angler isn't fishing for bluefish? I mean, you literally can't, yeah. Right? And so the law enforcement is told that, I guess we're beating a dead horse here, but it's incomprehensible, some of the stuff that we're looking at right now. I think we're right around an hour. We've got to finalize our letter tonight, Tony. We're finalizing our webpage with all of the information. You know, again, some people, Tony looks dead because he realizes we're not going to bed till like 2. Saddle up, boy. But like, some of the people who have like already made their call to action and submitted letters. I mean, how did you do that before the TC report came out and before this informational meeting tonight, where you actually got to ask for clarity about all this stuff? I mean, this is, if you want to go through the process and give justice to the process and play by the rules, now we're faced against this timeline. Well, we got to turn this around tonight because this all has to be available. But it would have been very inappropriate for us to have bold proclamations against what's on the table without being able to ask questions against them. Now that we have the information, bold proclamations inbound. So Tony, if you have any closing words, what I'd say from a communication standpoint, what people can expect, we're going to put as much of this information live tomorrow morning and maybe into tomorrow midday, depending how much sleep we get. And after that, guys, it's just, we need you. We need you to sign on. We need you to speak up. You're going to see emails. You'll see social posts. You'll see videos. Brand representatives, if you work at a brand or connected with a brand as a pro, as a guide, as a rec angler, as a repeat customer, we need the sign-ons again. We would never just duplicate the brands and the names who signed on a couple weeks ago or whatever it was a month or so ago. Now we're going to do this. If it's justice and it's honest and in integrity, this is our latest update based on what's available. And we need as many people to sign on as possible. You can submit your own letter. We will make sure people have the path to do so as well. But this is where the rubber meets the road. And if you want to see action that isn't on the table right now, you got to speak up so loud that a manager sees that so many people are watching and they go to bat on our behalf. I mean, look at this meeting that's scheduled, Tony. This was, we didn't push for a December 16th, a December meeting to consider new options. We said, this is what the fishery needs. And some heroes of conservation fought on our behalf when you kind of, in these meetings, when you have to sit back and watch the play unfold. And it's really nerve wracking. So more to come tomorrow. We need you this weekend. We need you Monday. We need you Tuesday. I believe the deadline is Tuesday at midnight. We're going to extend our opening for people to sign on as late as we possibly can to execute this organizationally. But closing words, unless Tony has any, is the rubber meets the road, guys, and we need you now.
Yeah, my only closing thought, I wanted to let you guys go because I was loving what you were saying. So my only thought is this. We have not changed as an association. We follow the science. We believe in the science. But when it, there is science that doesn't make any sense. And one of the things is, if it's based on a false assumption, the whole premise, and this is, and then the other thing is there a fairness? You know, there's no fairness to science, but the application of the data, are you going to take a pause and make sure that it's fair up and down the coast for people who want to harvest fish, for people who have shorter seasons? This is not fair. Based, you know, built on we kept sending the gift tonight. You sit on a throne of lies. Like, that's kind of, you know, like we're not the smartest people on earth, but I'm not going to blindly just be like, okay, they said the word science, so I have to believe them. There's a lot of ego in science, a lot more than I ever thought there would be, but there is tons of ego. And then there's also, you know, it's almost criminal. You look at some of these committees that are, you know, have people sitting on them that are from certain states, and they can plant these little seeds in the data that manifest themselves, you know, like Maryland did. Oh, look at how much we beat our reductions by because of these no target closures. You know, y'all, I have a degree in economics. And if you put a bunch of numbers in front of me and you tell me what you want them to say, I can probably make them say it. Actually, I know I can. And you really have to be, when you start dealing with statistics and modeling and stuff like that, people get pretty slick if they want. And, you know, that using that 2018 as a baseline and not recognizing that there are no juvenile fish, that's weak. It's super weak. Doesn't pass the muster on our deal. So what I'm trying to do is explain to y'all that we do 100% follow the data, follow the science, support it, unless it's not good. And this is not good. And I know they didn't have a lot of time, but the stuff on the table, it's just not acceptable in a lot of ways. And the other thing that I want y'all to remember is, if you look at the second bullet point in the findings of the TC, it says that if we stay at F2024, which I'm pretty sure we're going to stay at, we don't even need to take a reduction. That isn't going to be our position, but the bad folks, you can bet that's going to be their position. Maybe their fallback when they try to push things hard in another direction. So you really, when you do this policy and strategy stuff, you have to look at it and you have to think, what is possible? What is best for the resource? What can we get done to move the ball down the field? And we have been very effective at that. With striped bass conservation, dare I say, the most effective. So y'all are going to see our letter tomorrow. And when you see it, understand that it's a combination of what we think we can get done, what we think is best for the resource, and the future of striped bass. And it's not going to follow lockstep with the presentation that we saw tonight. But I hope y'all respect us for being honest about it and not losing our way. And I hope that gives you a good understanding of where we're coming from and where we're going. So we really appreciate y'all putting your faith and trust in us, and we would never do anything in the world to take that away. That's all we got. We're trying our best. We're going to work through the night. We're going to get this done. And I hope you understand the motivation behind it. And we're doing the best we can for Stripers.